You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Foz Mamoon, and Seth Miller.
So way back in the day, we were like, oh, we got to record, and we couldn't get all together. And I think I was on the road somewhere. I was in either, like, randomly in Germany or Denmark or something. I was like, I'll just record a random monologue. That counts, right? Yeah, it was awful.
That was probably the shortest show, though.
Oh, yeah. It was like 7 minutes of me monologuing. And in my brain, it was 7 minutes, which means it was almost certainly like 20.
All right. Let's jump into this. For Dots, so we've got some interesting stuff going on. San Francisco is one of our dots, and Chicago is the other one. We've talked about kind of both of these airports before. But San Francisco and Alaska there's some new lines coming out of there. That Alaska's adding, mostly on Virgin America metal.
Yeah, almost I think all on Virgin metal.
Oh, that's right, because LAX is to Mexico City is Alaska, right? That's going to be on their actual metal.
And they got San Francisco, Mexico City, so that one will be on Alaska metal as well, just because the way the Route Authority grant works, and they apply for it that way.
Gotcha.
But of the others, I think only two of them, Albuquerque and Kansas City, I think, are going to be on E75s. And then you've got, like, Indianapolis, Nashville,
Pittsburgh.
Raleigh, Durham. There's just
Philadelphia.
Philadelphia, not Pittsburgh, yeah. A slew of A320 family routes coming back.
Yep.
Or coming. And Philadelphia's coming back, technically. That one, Virgin America tried, I think I looked it up the other day, from 2012 to 2014.
And it just didn't do well?
No, they had no feed, and it was a weaker competitive position.
Yep.
We're a much smaller brand.
Yep.
It's interesting. This is one of those scenarios where, like, did a merger actually help competition?
And specifically at SFO. Because this could lower cost prices for consumers a little bit, because they're going head-to-head with United on most of these routes. On all of them, I think.
All but San Jose, Tucson. Oh, there's a couple out of San Jose. I think San Jose is the only uncontested route that they're launching.
Yeah. And because Raleigh-Durham out of San Francisco is relatively new on United, Indianapolis is relatively new, I think Albuquerque is relatively new. So these are kind of like dig in the side of United,
yeah,
which is an interesting strategy.
Well, I mean, that was sort of Virgin America's strategy for a while. I think, you know, we were joking earlier about a different story, but Brett over at Cranky Flyer wrote about this one as well, and we'll get to the other one in a minute, but... His comment was essentially, you know, A, look, competition can happen. And B, this is, you know, useful and important and, like, relevant in terms of how United has added routes and now, you know, sort of seeing that the market for these flights does exist, just not always with 130 seats or 150 seats.
True.
And that's the 75s. And then you also have the feed. You really do. I mean, it really is a much bigger overall company with much, you know, greater ability to pull corporate contracts, greater selection of destinations. All of those things actually does matter.
Yeah, and thinking about it, Alaska's strategy on the West Coast seems to have taken a little bit of a turn with the Virgin America merger. They were going to do a big expansion here at PDX, and they were going to take over like the e-concourse where United is, and that plan has been kind of scrapped. And Southwest will now take over those gates, and Alaska will stay where they are, which raises the question, are they going to expand PDX like they originally had planned?
Well, they still are adding a few routes for you, right?
I mean, they're adding a few, but I mean, originally the plan was like add a bunch with E-175s. That was like their thing, was they were going to have a bunch of these one-off kind of, rather than connecting through Seattle for us, they were going to just fly the routes straight out of PDX. And I would like to see if that's actually going to happen now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, good news, bad news. You guys aren't as important as San Francisco.
I completely understand that.
But let me rephrase that. You don't have as much traffic as San Francisco.
We do not have the traffic or the startups, which is part of it.
Yeah. You know, everybody says it's the startups. Maybe startups are different, like, now or out there or something. I feel like, you know, there's such a thing as business travel, and that matters. But, like, startup doesn't necessarily mean... you know, let's go flying every week. I feel like the couple startups that I've been involved in, there have been maybe one or two people traveling, but a lot of the people are, like, sitting somewhere actually working.
Yeah, true. I mean, I guess you're not – I don't know if you were working for one of the ones that's, like, you know, got $40 million and they make no money or something. But
yeah, that's a fair point. It's like, oh shit, we got money. Let's just go fly around and have fun. I mean, not really. They all do. Mostly do try to actually make money.
Do some work, right?
Deliver on whatever promise they've made to their investors. But
the other dot is Chicago. An American is adding a bunch of new routes, similar to United's expansion that they announced. I don't know what's that been now? A couple weeks now.
Yeah.
So they're adding Colorado Springs. They're adding Appleton, Wisconsin, Boise, Greensboro, North Carolina, Greenville, South Carolina, Ontario, California. I mean, there's a lot of routes in this.
Charlottesville, Virginia, or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, Charlottesville. I worked in Charlottesville for a while.
Interesting.
Nice little town. Not much going on.
Yeah, I mean, and just, I know we didn't talk about this before, but since you mentioned Colorado Springs, you should add that as a third dot.
Oh, with the Frontier stuff?
Yeah, because Frontier decided that's where they're going to expand now, which, as an aside, they did that once before and it failed miserably and it's unclear what's changed, so.
Hang on, Foz and I discussed this last show a little bit, touched on it. Clearly you did not listen.
No, I just edited it. I produced it, but I didn't mean I have to listen to it, right?
You should maybe get the levels right, all that.
No,
we did mention Colorado Springs because Frontier's kind of flying these like random routes out of there, even though they've done this before.
Okay.
It actually got pointed out in the comments of the show that they had flown some of these routes before.
Okay, so scratch that. Go back and listen to 132 if you want to listen to Colorado Springs. Back to Chicago.
But let's talk about these Chicago routes. I mean, this is very similar to what United's doing.
Yes.
And Cranky Flyer, we'll put the link in the show notes. His analysis of it is kind of hysterical. And the title's the best part. I mean, the title of the article is American and United Fight to See Who Can Lose More Money in Small Cities.
Yeah.
Which is the truth. I mean, most of these are like little one-off routes that the traffic must be – they think they can make some money off of it. But
this is the traditional hub and spoke business model. If I get three extra passengers a day because, you know, on Chicago, San Francisco, because three people need to go from Charlottesville to San Francisco and they choose my connection, that lets me charge more to everybody else because that demand goes up. And I've got 15 cities, so that's 45 passengers, three go into each, and that fills an E45.
Yep.
Right? I mean, that's the theory behind it. It's the story. I mean, you want to go way, way, way back. This is United dropping Houston Paris because Southwest opened up at Hobby International Service, right? It's the same argument that was made then, which is they're going to have more connecting flow and we can't support it.
Yep. It makes sense. I have my doubts that this will work long term.
Yeah. It is one of those like, well, it makes sense if you have full faith in the way the system theoretically operates, but and I know the US market and the European market remain very different, but having spent far too much time in Europe the last couple weeks/months and seeing the plethora of nonstop point-to-point services that operate, I don't know, man. This whole hub-and-spoke thing seems stupid sometimes.
And it seems like a weird allocation of flying, just even if it's from a regional jet perspective, to say, okay, this feed that we're going to have, if you can't pull in fares to support that feed, like, is it worth it? And what I mean by that is, if you're offering European coach class fares from Appleton to Paris via Chicago for, I don't know, $400, are you actually making any money off of that fare?
Probably not.
And how sustainable is that over the long term, depending on how much you fill up the business cabin? I mean, I guess that's really where the question is you know, how many people are actually flying from Appleton to Paris on business or wherever?
Yeah, and, you know, is it Paris? Is it San Francisco? Is it who knows, right? I mean, if you listen to Scott Kirby, formerly president of American Airlines and US Airways, and now president of United, for, you know, who theoretically knows kind of everything that's going on between these two airlines within the last year or two, you know, his argument recently was Denver is United's best hub because it's a lot of relatively short-haul connecting traffic from secondary cities in the Midwest and West.
So utilization is good.
So utilization is high. It's routes that don't have other alternatives necessarily, and so fares remain high. This is not your, you know, transcon market where competition keeps round trips below $300 between New York and LA in coach, right, for advanced purchase, or certainly below $400 on a pretty regular basis. Right?
So
this is instead of flying 2,500 miles or 2,300 miles for $400 round trip, you're flying a pair of 300-mile flights at that same or higher price point because there's no competition, no one's going to drive it, etc. And you can actually build massive yields.
Yeah. So is do you think this strategy from American was put in place possibly, like this idea was put in place possibly before Kirby left? Like this was on his plan, and someone found his notebook somewhere and said, "Let's do this." Or is this just the way the market is going?
Yes.
To all of the above.
All hip hop. I mean, he's not the only person that has had this idea. Clearly, he's talked about it publicly a ton. Right. This is not, and this isn't new to the industry. We certainly have gone through cycles, but when domestic travel was collapsing, the legacy or larger carriers expanded internationally with yields down transatlantic and massive competition there, semi-collapsing trans-Pacific market and huge inflow of Chinese competitors that are trashing yields there, and South America theoretically starting to recover depending on who you listen to, but not really quite there yet, and you got new planes coming in and you got all this and you got to do something to try to make a little more money.
Yep.
Maybe it's time to look domestic again.
Yeah,
and that
makes sense.
Yeah, and I mean, he's not the only one who said it. There's been a lot of discussion about this sort of thing, and all of the recent earnings calls from all the airlines, and sort of just trying to figure it out. We are approaching a situation where there's something of a saturation. You've got enough large players that they either have to take their existing resources and make them more profitable, or get very, very creative about finding new places to go, and that's arguably why I'm considering a flight from Cork to Providence, Rhode Island on July 1st.
Are you still considering it?
Yeah, I haven't. Well, let's put it this way. I haven't bought anything else yet.
Gotcha.
Okay. So, considering it, but well, not really there.
Staying on the topic of American, let's talk about their transcons, specifically San Francisco and Los Angeles to JFK. They are going to be adding free meals and economy back to those flights.
Yeah.
This is kind of in line with what Delta's done, right?
Yep. Delta started a little while back.
And so...
Actually, I think Delta started it today. They announced it a little while back.
Yeah.
March 14th-ish, a couple days before we record, obviously before it released, because it's us.
Yeah. And so American's saying, we'll do the same thing on those transcon routes. Is this a sign, kind of what we were talking about with saturation? Is this a sign of saturation? Where now the market is so saturated with flights and cheap flights at that, that they have to distinguish themselves by giving better service?
Yeah, that's the theory. I mean, right? We go back and forth on this all the time of like, do I lead with price? Do I lead with service? Do people pay for service?
Yep.
And are we making enough money that we can try to pretend that's the case? At some level... Delta's been pretty profitable lately. American, much less so, but they're trying, ish. there's this theory that, and I fully subscribe to it, that it, given a chance, some people will pay a tiny bit extra for better service.
Yeah,
it's unclear exactly how many and who they are, and if I'm even one of them. But some weeks I am, and some weeks I'm not. So there you go. It's true. I mean.
Yeah, no, I get it. Some weeks you feel like you need the extra leg room. Some weeks you don't.
Yeah, and yeah, leg room is important. Meals are less significant to me, although I've been feeling it more lately, having been on a few transcons that had craptacular meal service.
Yeah.
Did I say transcons? I meant transatlantics. Sorry. Where you get to like Halifax coming westbound, you're like, damn, I'm hungry, and there's no food available. That's a different rant for a different day.
That's disappointing, actually.
Don't try to take a second fun-size candy bar from the British Airways flight attendants. They are not used.
We only have enough for everyone, sir.
That was literally what they say, and they pull the basket away. You don't get the second one. It doesn't matter how pathetic you look. And if your seatmate declines, you don't get his or hers. It's.
You should just tell your seatmate, take the damn thing. I'll take it from you.
It was at that point, it was awkward. Let's just but anywho, I am happy to see a return of meals and economy, right? Delta went so far as to do the branded meals thing following on their branded snacks play. So not only are they serving them and getting sort of the recognition and customer love, but they're also dealing with someone like helping pay for it through sponsorships and, getting, you know, the marketing of getting your food in front of, or your product in front of all these, you know, people.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I mean, I think it's good for consumers, of course. It's a weird dynamic because now you have these different service levels on these flights within the airline, right? Everyone kind of knew that international flights, long-haul international flights would get meals, but and you didn't get a meal on a domestic flight. And now it's like, kind of, maybe, sort of. You know what I mean? Like, it seems like a differentiation problem within the airline. Or am I just crazy? Not really.
A little bit?
Yeah.
Yeah, it does provide differentiation within the airline, right? There are some routes that are, you know, more equal than others.
Yeah.
And the transcon market, I mean, a few years back, I want to say 2013, 2014-ish, when, like, the flatbed scenario took over. JetBlue launched their flatbeds in 2014 with Mint, and that, like, was the beginning of the so-called transcon wars. You know, and that was at the same time that Coach was probably the most miserable it's been on those routes. It was a time when there was less service. They were cutting back and only really looking at the front cabin. And again, now they've got some money and they're sort of, that pendulum is swinging back.
Yeah. Yep.
Which is good. I am happy to hear that things are getting better.
Do you think United will follow suit now? I mean, I guess that's the burning question that people have.
I would be shocked if they didn't. I kind of feel like they have to.
Yeah.
But
it makes sense to me. I mean, it would be the obvious, like, news story. United's the only one that doesn't offer meals on transcons.
Yeah. JetBlue still is buy on board, too.
That's
Virgin
true.
America is still buy on board, too. Or,
yeah. You know,
under the Alaska umbrella. So we're not 100% there yet, and Delta's doing it on way more routes. Half of the Delta routes are actually JetBlue competition, not American.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're and American. But, you know, there's a bunch of Boston transcons that are mostly JetBlue competition. So, or Seattle transcons. Like, it's a lot of everything. But
yep.
I would be surprised if United doesn't, you know, follow the leader, as it were. They all sort of move in lockstep on some of these things. If, you know, if one can cut pitch half an inch, they all would love to. If they have to give back a little, they all will. And United has also been making money, just like Delta, or not as much as, but more than American has, right? Less than Delta recently. So they have the cash to spare if they want to do it, and they can afford to invest in their product on board a little bit. We don't, depends on who you listen to and the economics of it, but it doesn't look like fuel prices are going to spike anytime soon.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to say, I mean, that could lead us into our next topic, but finish your thought.
No, I was saying that the only other thing that we've sort of heard the discussions about in terms of, you know, the pendulum going back and forth is giving back benefits on the frequent flyer side.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, I think the airlines are much more inclined to give you a meal on board than more points or more status for a cheap ticket.
Yep. Yep. Speaking of topics that have to do with fuel prices, Delta has actually hired a consulting firm.
Reportedly.
To talk about the sale or closure of their refinery outside of Philadelphia. The Trainer facility. And this is interesting. I mean, the consultancy is really there to give them reportedly analysis on what the impact would be on jet fuel prices if the facility was to close.
Yeah, and there's all sorts of interesting here. I mean, all sorts of.
I don't think we've actually gotten, like, a real clear picture of what Delta thinks of the refinery till now. Like, we've seen reports that, at the beginning they said, it's doing great. Then we heard some financial stuff that said it's doing terrible now. And now they're trying to sell it. Or get rid of it, or close it, or do something.
Remember, at one point it switched from, it's profitable, to, it's helping us control prices, this is our fuel hedge, to now who knows. Right? And so there is a little bit of who knows what they're thinking. They've used it for any number of purposes, whatever sort of seems convenient at the time, and in some ways avoided talking about really what's going on there other than they have it. And I don't know, maybe they were happier when fuel was at 100 because they had it.
But I can't see that, though, because you're buying fuel stock at
you're buying the you know you're buying
oil
crude,
you're right? buying Yeah, you're buying the crude at 100 or whatever the price is, and even if you can refine it efficiently, you're not going to make that money back. Like, you're not making that back. So I would think right now it's like, oh, we should be refining all we can. And, you know, I mean, that's kind of how the refinery business works, is when oil prices kind of fall, refineries tend to do okay. I mean, there's other conditions involved as well, but they tend to do all right. And so it's interesting to me that they say, oh, we're actually analyzing closing it. Maybe they're forecasting fuel prices, you know, oil prices going up and the refinery being unsustainable in – you know, the next 5 to 10 years or something like that. That could certainly be it.
Yeah. I mean, and at the end of the day, it still comes down to, is that going to be profitable for Delta, sort of the holding, you know, the big picture, not necessarily the airline, but the big picture company overall with everything else. And
yeah.
How do I know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you think about like maintenance and things over time, it takes a lot of money to run a refinery. And if you're not skilled in it and it's not your core competency, you know, you are an airline, I could see it being something you just kind of want to get off the books. And with a new CEO, you remember the refinery was purchased under what's his name, and now
is it Anderson now?
Richard Anderson, right? Yeah, it was purchased under, I thought, yeah, you said, sorry. Henderson. It was purchased under Richard Anderson, and you have a new CEO now who could have just a different take on leading the company forward. And he just doesn't like the economics of running a refinery, which I don't disagree with. So, interesting stuff. Lastly, we're gonna get to 35 minutes, I think, maybe, depending on how long we talk about Berlin and our destination, since we've already talked about Berlin. But you were just there again.
I've been there a lot lately.
For ITB. Yeah, you've spent a lot of time.
I don't know how Rollo used to go to ITB, man.
Why?
I couldn't deal. It's a massive, massive event. So ITB Berlin is this international trade show for travel. And it's a combination. It's like destination marketing and airlines and technology companies all together in this massive, massive event. The conference site where it's held, the Messe, M-E-S-S-E, which best I can tell is German for giant collection of buildings where you meet people. Is, I want to say, it's split across 26 buildings.
Sheesh.
And they're big. I mean, these are like huge conference center rooms. Some of them have multiple floors, which is relatively uncommon in conference centers in my experience. Maybe not. Maybe I don't feel like I often see 3-story conference centers like that.
Yeah, that's big, man.
And like, it was just huge. It was, you look around and it's room after room of like, you know, these 4 rooms are the Caribbean and Latin America and South America. These 3 rooms are the Middle East, and the booths, you know, the Emirates booth was 3 stories with a full setup of a first class suite and the business class bar in it. And the new business class bar was there. Like, it was the Qatar Airways one had a 4 block of its new suite, Q suite business class seats. And then like across, and that was like their ancillary booth because they had their main booth where they had a meeting room set up and all these other things. It was just, it's this, you know, and not everybody's that big, but it's this huge, huge thing. And there's so many people, and it's kind of overwhelming for me. But
so it's much bigger than Interiors Expo, Aircraft Interiors Expo, which is in Hamburg. Yeah.
Easily double the size would be my guess.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, maybe even larger.
So tell me about Berlin. You told me about the ITB, but tell me about Berlin. Did you see more this time during this trip?
Which helps. Turns out, like, getting out of the hotel room and going and seeing things makes the city nicer. in my defense, like, the first time I was there, I had to change my flights and didn't really get out. The second time, I was too tired, I think. And so the third time was I was only in the country for 25 minutes.
We'll give you a pass.
I saw a great line at the airport, though, man. Tegel. Had to stamp in so I could get to the security line to stamp out. So this last time, I was able to spend a few days in, partly because I was so overwhelmed by the trade show and partly because I was kind of just there to see what it was like and I didn't have any real obligations. I was able to, you know, play hooky, essentially my second day there and like go do other things. And so it's a huge city. I don't think I ever quite realized how physically spread out it is. And so dealing with sort of trains and figuring that out was interesting. And, you know, I think we talked about it a little bit, maybe not on the show 2 ago when we were talking about my lodgings, but pre-show, like, just figuring that out, and I was like, yeah, so I'll find this place that's, like, 25 minutes to the to the hall. And it was 25 to 30 minutes to get there, but like, I don't know, it seemed like we went through so many stops in so many different neighborhoods and like all the way across town. And, you know, I was yep. definitely in East Berlin over by Alexanderplatz area, so that was interesting. And that's just, it's a whole different side of what's going on architecturally and whatnot, a lot of block-style architecture, block-style buildings. But you also get the little crosswalk dude.
Yeah, I'm
full. And I learned this, he's consistently in East Germany and only randomly in West, or East Berlin,
yeah,
West Berlin.
Pretty much.
So that was, you know, interesting. But saw the Charlottenburg Schloss, the castle?
The kind of castle, yeah. Yeah, inside a garden behind it,
yep. Which was also really pretty. Even, I mean, it was sunny and warm. Warmish the day we were out. It was, you know, comfortable to walk around. It wasn't summer by any stretch. Nothing had really started blooming, but you could see they were getting the gardens ready. So that was really mm-hmm. cool. And like, you know, it's good news, bad news. Like we made it through the walking portion of that tour in probably 30 or 40 minutes. Like to the point that when we walked in, it was like, are you sure you want to pay to come in? It's closing very soon. Part of our answer was, well, we really need to use your bathroom. So yes, part of the answer. And we just wanted to see it. What's weird about it a little bit is that it's set up as art galleries inside the rooms, as opposed to like, this is what the room looked like X hundred years ago when someone was living here. So a couple of rooms were set up that way. You saw some that had a bed or something else that sort of helped, but it was more art gallery than this is what life was like. And it's almost all reconstruction. Apparently the Allies bombed the hell out of that thing.
Yeah, Berlin was pretty much laid to waste during the war. So.
but you know, speaking of, we also went to, there's a Timeline of Terrors or something like that museum.
Oh yeah, I'm getting
the name of it wrong.
The Topographies of Terror.
Yeah, I know it had to start with a T. It was, that one was challenging. That's not an uplifting experience, particularly. But yeah, it was a very interesting experience there, but I only after I sort of walked, and that is, so that's a museum that sort of tracks the history of the rise of the Nazi Party and a lot of the fascism and killings that happened over the 15-ish years from the early 30s to the mid 40s. And there's a sort of permanent exhibit covers Germany and some of the areas that, you know, World War II they expanded out into with the Third Reich, and then we were eventually pushed back from. There was a separate temporary exhibit about some of the mass shooting deaths as opposed to some of the sort of concentration camp stuff, which was just, you know, also very interesting and terrifying and humbling and, you know, sad, but it was a very cool exhibit. But only when I walked back outside, there's also a huge chunk of the Berlin Wall still there right out in front. So it's, I think, probably the largest remaining piece, so you can get yourself in front of the Berlin Wall if you want. But to me, the interesting part about that was, while I was standing outside looking at the wall, there's also sort of a trench below it. And I looked at it like, this doesn't make sense. The wall wouldn't have had a trench like that. Like, the trench looks like the building, it looks like the base of a typical building with like windows and doors, not a wall. And so I read the sign next to it. It was like, yes, this is where this building was that was the head of whatever part of Nazi Germany. And I don't remember specifically which buildings it was. But, so that museum is actually built on what was essentially a block, a full sort of square block that was completely raised. And like partly bombed out and then bulldozed. And that was where most of the headquarters for the various, all the killings basically were organized. I'm blanking on words. Sorry.
The SS
and just that whole, like all of those groups that were responsible for the purges were based there.
Yeah.
And now the only thing that's sort of left of that, and that's, so that's the, what you see in this trench is sort of the base of those buildings, the footings. And then there's this sort of little museum that's been built on top of it, but it looks very temporary and sort of strange sitting now on top of it in the middle of this block that's completely bulldozed. So that was interesting.
Yeah. There's so much stuff there historically. I think a lot of people get caught up in like Checkpoint Charlie and things like that, that if you go just like – if you just spend a little bit of time going to things like the Topography of Terrors, there's a whole underworld museum. So like – it's the bomb shelters that were used during World War II. There's a whole museum underground, and it's like they walk you through these old bunkers. And then there's also a same tour company does Cold War bunkers and like tunnels that people use to get from East Berlin to West Berlin. Fascinating stuff. And it's just, you just got to take the time to look for it. I mean, it is a it's such a huge city that there's stuff all over, and things like, even in the suburbs like Potsdam and Pankow and different places that aren't in Berlin proper and would take you probably an hour to get to, but are fascinating things. So there's the old hill Teufelsberg, which is the listening station for the CIA. And it sits kind of like on a hill above the city, and it's abandoned now. And I think it's actually closed right now. But you can go like check out this old abandoned listening station, which is fascinating. I mean, the history there is just fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, and depressing. So
yeah, that was it, fascinating and depressing, I think, is really how I came out of that part of the walking around. Obviously, that museum is somewhat designed to be like that. But
yep.
The good news is we went from there to lunch, and I went back to Rogaki, which I know you've told me several times, get there. And
yep.
To be fair, I was like, yeah, sure, whatever. I played it off a little bit. it had to be relatively convenient and easy. And actually, so I went the first time when I played hooky from the train show on Friday, and then I went back on Saturday and took some friends because it was that good. And it was – what was interesting to me about it is sort of comparing it. It's has like raw meats for sale, right? Like a butcher. So there's mm-hmm. like a poultry section. There's a beef section. There's like cured meats and whatnot. That sort of things. And then there's a bakery. There's those sorts of things. And it's a food hall, sort of, but not really. And then it's got, in the back, this restaurant sort of environment. So in the back is the fish section. And there's, like, smoked fishes and shellfish and, you know, normal swimming fish and whatever. But there's also these, like, a couple open-air kitchens in the middle of it all where you can walk up and they've got menus and piles of, you know, goods. Mostly. And I didn't completely understand if you could just go, like, buy a random piece of fish and then bring it over to the counter if you were supposed to order off the menu. I ordered from the menus, given my limited German and Google Translate effect. But it was really good. It was really, really good. Just like, you know, it's all fresh food. You know the meats and fish are fresh. And they're having a good time doing it.
Yep.
I think at the end of it all, that's really what made it sort of amazing to me, is you could see that they were working their asses off, but, like, smiling and playing with each other and having the whole staff was just having a really good time.
Yeah, and they have a good time with the customers too. Just a good, you know, they'll have conversations. It's yeah. We were there during a weekday and we went for lunch. We usually go for lunch. It's like our healthy thing. Like it's not typical German.
The same things I did if it was healthy, but
yeah, I mean fish is healthy.
Not when you drown it in butter, but it's not and put it in pasta, but sure.
It's not your typical German fare. Yes. I think it's a nice change of pace from
Bayesian
if you're
fried.
Eating. Yeah, exactly. And stew. So for us, like my wife gets a soup. You know, whenever there's a soup that they have that's just amazing, and it kind of changes up
on the menu. But I'm sure there's others too.
Oh yeah, and that's the fish soup that she likes. She loves it because it's like there's still chunks of fish in it, and so it's. You know, it's really great. And then there's the other feature of it that the first time we went, I found fascinating, is over to the one side, there's a cafeteria style line. Yeah. And it's kind of like, you know, pick from the menu, and it's cheap. And it is meant as like a blue collar meal.
Huge portions.
Through that line. Yeah. Huge portions. Guys just coming in from working. They grab a meal there quick. They have the standing tables where you just kind of stand and eat it real quick. And then
seats.
Yeah, and I loved that because it was this experience. And everyone there that we saw was someone coming in from work or just running a quick errand, grabbing something and grabbing a bite to eat while they grabbed it, you know. And I just liked that experience. It felt local to me. And it sounds stupid, but it felt like a city – kind of like your city market, you know, somewhere you would just go, like a normal spot.
Yeah, so
you
what's
down the street
interesting to me is the previous trip, I was going to go. I was ready to do it, and it was 6:30 on a Monday night.
Mm-hmm.
And they closed at 7. Closed. So I wasn't going to get there. And I happened to be staying that time. I was in the Zoologic Garden area near the zoo.
Yep.
And just up the street from Kaufhaus der Westens, the Kadaway.
Yep.
Kadaway. Right, which is the famous, truly largest food market in Europe or Germany, or it's this massive thing. And it's basically, it's a department store, and the top floor of it is the food hall. And you go up, and it really is, I mean, it absolutely is huge. And it's impressive. And I walked through it, and I was so disappointed. And I don't remember if we talked about this
and depending
on the show or not. But, like, I was so disappointed in it, and so I was a little gun-shy about food halls and trying Rogaki, because I didn't want to be disappointed again. And it turns out it was, like, the exact opposite.
Yeah, I think Kadaway has kind of, I don't know, maybe elevated itself too high. We've been there a few times, we've kind of stopped going when we go back to Berlin, just because we enjoy Rogaki more, and there's other places that we enjoy more in Berlin. Kadaway's great if you just want to pick up something while you're shopping anyway, and you're there. Like, that's to me is what it's there for. But it's expensive, and it's mediocre. Well, like, the food's just...
I struggled to find, like, a good prepared food section. I think I was talking with... So the people, my friends who I took back to Rogaki the second night, I was sort of talking to them. One of the guys was working at the trade show, so he didn't tour that much. His wife was there, and she was spent the week, you know, tooling around in Berlin. And so I asked her if she went to Kadaway, and she's like, yeah. And I'm like, good, I want your opinion too. And hers was very similar to mine, which was like, when you're walking through Kadaway and you see that there's a Moet and Chandon section, like they've got their own little booth. Like that to me was the tipping point for, this isn't a traditional food market. This is a space where a bunch of shops have set up that all sort of sell food, but it's not a coherent operation that's trying to attract people.
Yeah, the concept there too is they have the similar thing where, you know, you have like the little food stall open air restaurant areas.
I don't remember, but I just don't remember, so it didn't make that good an impression on me.
And the thing that it is that you have to walk around like the outside, like it's only on the outside. Nothing's in the center
of
like that's all like prepared stuff.
Yeah, so I feel like I did see some people eating at some of the outside sections.
Yeah, and even those are kind of disappointing a little bit, but there are a couple, like we went there and had a beer and just kind of hung out one evening because we were kind of tired, but we were at the train station right there, and you know, I was like, let's just go grab a beer. How often do you get to grab a beer at a Macy's?
That's essentially what it is. No, yeah. Maybe Marcus, in that context,
so
I'll give it
that's
to you.
My
it
feeling
just, it was, it didn't have, you know, it didn't have a feel of authenticity to me, or...
Yep, I get that.
You know, like that sort of canned goods section. I'm used to, you know, New York City grocery markets where we cram as much crap as you can onto the shelves as possible. And Kadaway was like this sort of fancy artisanal look. We have three cans on this shelf to make it look pretty.
It's the
hipster. There's just a lot of little things like that made me, you know, I live in Chelsea, New York City now, and I have Chelsea Market as my sort of local grocery store. And it's a mix of the seafood place, which still has real, true sort of retail fish market, but now the vast majority of their revenue, I'm pretty sure, of the retail revenue certainly, comes from selling oysters and steamed lobsters to tourists.
Yeah. Well, and to be fair, like I think Berlin, there's a bunch of – I sent you another like set of stuff to go visit, like places to eat at. And some of the stuff was, you know, in Far East Berlin that you probably would have had a hard time getting to. It would have taken a long time. So I think I tell people whenever they go, I'm like, oh, you know, if you have time, go to Kadaway. But if you don't have time, go to
Rogaki
for sure.
First.
Like, if you want to go somewhere,
do it first. I mean, I don't know. It's just like, there's just a couple, like, I clearly don't speak German. I can barely point and figure out what I'm ordering. But like, order a glass of Riesling while I'm having it and enjoying my meal. And the first day, the waitress actually brought the little credit card machine over for me to pay my bill, just refilled my glass because I don't know. But she said something and smiled and filled my glass up. So I went with it. And then quit that because I'm going to the gym. And then the second day, I ordered something that was supposed to come with potatoes on the side, and I was actually really looking. They were like potatoes with bacon and onions, and they were going to be delicious. And I watched the guy preparing them, and my fish came and didn't have it. And I said, hey, you know, kartoffels. And he's like, oh, yeah, 2 minutes. And they never showed up. And I eventually got over it, but I didn't want to pay for them. And so when the waiter came over to bring the bill, I'm like, by the way, I never got my kartoffels, which mixing English and bad German clearly confused them. But and the, you know, that it's this sort of like open air thing where the chef is right there. So he looks over and he's like, yeah, you got him. I'm like, no, remember you told me 2 minutes? And then they never showed up. He's like, you know, mortified the short order cook, because short order cook missing something on an order is terrible. But the waiter says, don't worry. And instead of writing it off the bill or whatever else, just came over, and there were three of us there at that point, and we had a bottle of wine already, and basically used our glasses to pour another bottle of wine. Like, so,
well,
again,
friendly
maybe
of them.
The answer is just get everybody drunk and then they love you no matter what. But they clearly, both of my experiences ended up in large volumes of free wine. So I'm a fan.
I'm glad you enjoyed
it.
I'm glad
really
you liked
good.
It. There
like,
are,
it really is proper fresh seafood and everything else. And they had, someone was having a duck breast while we were standing there. Most of what they serve is seafood, at least at the fresh cooked stuff, the buffet line has, you know, roast pork and whatever else also.
Yeah.
But it was really cool.
I, I need to just go through and like post my list of places to go in Berlin, because there are places that I don't like touristy type shops. Like, I kind of avoid them to begin with. And so I have a list of four or five places that we frequent in Berlin that I, and a few that have been introduced to us by friends of ours that live in Berlin, mutual friends of ours. And they're just, they're some of my favorite spots, and I'll go back to them every time. And it sounds terrible, but once you have a spot and like, it's really good. I mean, you know, you live in New York, you have your places. So yeah, I'm glad you liked it though.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's, I fully believe in getting out and exploring a city and seeing what comes of it. But when you're on trip number N back to whatever place you're going, and for me, admittedly, I don't have that many yet from Berlin, but sometimes you hit something that actually works. And if I'm going to have to, you know, if I'm going back to a city, I'm going to try to get to the one place I know I like and then see what else is out there, not always try to do something new. If for no other reason, then it's a little more comfortable, makes me, you know, it's easier to adjust into being a tourist and being on the road. If you have somewhere you know, and you sort of basis that you know is good.
It's a good place. It's like a little bit of home on the road. Like I'm there's a comfort level with having a place that I can go back to. I know what I'm going to get here. So I know that this one evening I'm going to have a dinner that I'm going to really enjoy, or a lunch that I'm really going to enjoy, and everything else I can kind of build around that. And so you can always go back to that place. I completely understand.
Yeah.
I'm with you, man. Totally. But yeah, I think that's a show. What do you think?
A great show.
To our listeners, you can find us on Twitter at @dotslines. moredotsmorelines.com is where we're at. Leave us a comment, leave us a review on iTunes, send us a tweet. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening, and until next time, bye bye.
Sometimes you just get lucky, and there's a bonus episode tucked into the end of the show. After we finished recording, Steven and I spent another solid 5 minutes talking about Rogaki, and, well, here you go.
Do
you speak German or just read German, or you fake it better than me?
I can read it. Like, I can figure out what things are, and I can speak enough of it to make myself dangerous. Like, to the point where they think I speak German, and they'll just continue talking to me in German. And I have to go English bitte. But I can read the menu. They do have English menus sometimes, depending on how much they've rotated it.
I Google translated my menu, and it was like, and I was there. The other couple I was with was like, yeah, we don't speak any German at all. I'm like, okay, so Kartoffel definitely means potato. and I use Google Translate. So like, this one says ziti mit. I'm like, so that's pasta with. And then I translated, and it was like, and she actually, what did she get to? Pasta with like. Shrimp. There's like 18 German words for different types of shrimp.
Yes. Nordseekrabben, which is like the itty-bitty ones.
And which Krabben confuses me, because I think Krabben should be crabs, and it's not. And Google Translate suffers
and no.
too. Like, Google Translate for German is actually pretty bad.
It's surprisingly bad. And because there's a lot of and especially in Berlin, because the language is different there. Like, there's some differences. Like Hendrik has explained some of the stuff. They still speak a type of German that's mostly slang. So that's probably part of where your translation.
Yeah, but it was like, so this is going to be something like that. This is like medallions of something, you know, escalope. And I'm like, well, that's not scallops, but you'll probably be fine. That's what the guy ordered. And he's like, scallops? And the woman's like, yeah, escalope. And we're like, I'm like, after you order, I'm like, I don't think that's actually scallops.
It was like probably like
meal. No, it was the seafood. I'd have to go back and I took a picture of his meal. I'd have to go back and I have it here. Figure out what he ate, and then I had mine.
Did on your second trip there? Did you get like tuna or what was that?
It was a salmon steak
or a salmon steak.
And so that's the one where it's lox something, lachs something something. But Google translated it as like wolf steak or something like that, or wolf fish or lamb fish. I was like, okay. And then I looked at him like, and then I saw the steak of salmon gone. I'm like, it's got to be mine, because it was the rest of our stuff. I'm like, I think I ordered salmon, because salmon is lox. I know that. And then I went back and looked at the menu, and of course, stupid me, I had at that point was only looking at the translation, not also at the German. And it was lox something. You know, it's in the German sense that we've got 18 letters, so we better use them all.
Lox is literally salmon.
Same as literally. Norwegian and all those languages, and also, you know, Jewish. So, I think I should have known. It was salmon with basically an ice cream scoop of herbed butter. It was delicious. He got his thing that said escalope ended up being jumbo prawns on a rice pilaf with tomato sauce.
Interesting.
Yeah, and hers was a really nice ziti with fresh veggies and like a velveted sauce of some sort. Like, we watched them do it. I'm like, I don't know what they're scooping. They scooped something out of this container. I'm like, I don't know what they're scooping, but we should go steal whatever it is because that shit was good.
So they enjoyed it too.
We had a blast. And then like
that's great.
I kind of wish I would have told this during the show. As we're standing there at the grill that day, one of the waitresses is walking by and she's like, you know, we're talking about they have so much fun with the other guests and like there's regulars and it's this thing. She's walking over with a like bottle of white wine to pour a guy a glass, and as she walks past the grill, like backhanded tosses us like a splash out, like just onto the grill. And the whole thing flares up.
Yep.
I'm like, what? Like, it caught all of our time. Not flares, like, steams up. I'm like, did that just happen?
Yep.
Just having fun. Like, instead of throwing the wine at the guy, just threw it over her shoulder at the grill and, like, flared up and sauteed everything real quick. It was just, like, this amazing, like, they have, partly because it's cheap and whatever, but, like, their idea of what wine is worth is entertainment value, not necessarily just for drinking.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and they're there to have a good time. And, like, we've had, I mean, when we were there just recently, this last year, the guy sitting next to us, like the lady was like having a conversation with us, and this guy comes up and he brings his newspaper and he's reading the newspaper and she goes, oh, blah, blah, blah. I haven't seen you in a few days. He's like, yeah, I was out of town or whatever. And that's like his lunch spot. Like, that's where he goes every day for lunch.
Yeah, it was really good.
Like, he didn't talk the rest of the time. Like, she brought him food.
Yeah.
Like, everything he wanted.
Yeah, there definitely was a guy who walked in. And I was like, oh, do you need the menu? Do you need to, like, let me make room for you? He's like, he just looked at me and laughed and shook his head. And, like, while I was waiting for my food, the waitress brought his prepared order over.
So she's like, no, she knows what time I show up, so that's cool.
And we actually also, bonus was, while we were, like, waiting to pay the bill, the wife of the couple went up front to buy some dessert. And we were planning just, like, to eat it out on the street or whatever. And then we ended up with bonus wine. So we just, like, unwrapped these pieces of cake and stood at the counter there and finished them. It was...
Oh, and they probably didn't even care?
At all. I mean, we bought it from them, so, like, they shouldn't. But also, it was really...
They were probably happy to have it.
This was, like, 3:30 on Saturday, and they close at 4 on Saturdays, so...
Yeah, they were having a good time. Well, I'm glad you liked it, man. That sounds like a lot of fun. And you